Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, and Judge Riley. The Honorable Denise Riley presiding. The second case is A210979, Kevin P. Sweetnam versus Sherry Sweetnam, aka Sherry Latkovich.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I hope Zoom works out okay for you with regard to appellate arguments. I understand that you'd rather have live testimony in person, and I totally appreciate that. You each will have 15 minutes. The rules will be similar as if we were actually in the courtroom, with 5 minutes of rebuttal for the appellant, should you choose to use it. Please state your name at the beginning of your argument. These are being recorded and will be posted on our court's website. And if at any time there are technical glitches, you freeze or we freeze, please let us know so that we can stop the clock. And with that, is appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Rob Merritt, representing the appellant in this case. And I suspect it will please the court that my comments are going to be very brief. We have a very straightforward issue on this appeal, whether the district court abuses its discretion by imposing sanctions against a represented party for asserting a legal contention that the court determines to be unwarranted by existing law. And there is a very succinct and direct answer to that issue. Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 11.03b1 states that monetary sanctions may not be awarded against a represented party for violation of Rule 11.02b. 11.02b obviously refers to asserting a claim or legal contention that is unwarranted by existing law or non-frivolous argument to extend, modify, or reverse the existing law. In this case, the trial court imposed sanctions against appellate for asserting a claim that the court determined was unwarranted by existing law. I know you've read the briefs and you're familiar with the background here, but briefly, the appellant, represented by counsel, commenced a lawsuit seeking a declaration that he was the sole owner of a piece of property up in Itasca County.
Yes. Judge Larkin, I'm going to interrupt because I think we are familiar with the facts. They're not unusually complicated. Do you think it is clear what the basis for the district court's imposition of sanctions was? There seems to be a dispute. You say it's clear. Respondent says, well, it's not so clear, and there were other reasons that could have justified it. What's your position on the assertion that it's the basis is not clear or not clearly stated?
Well, I think it is clearly stated, Your Honor, and you know, Rule 11.03C requires that the district court set forth the basis for the sanction, and here the district court did that in its conclusions of law, identifying the conduct that it found to be objectionable, and that conduct was pursuing the suit that the court found to be unwarranted because it was barred by the 6-year statute of limitations. And that was the issue that the court was presented on the motion for summary judgment, and the issue that the court ultimately ruled in favor of respondent on the underlying claims, that the suit was barred by the 6-year statute of limitations. Appellant's counsel at the district court had argued that a separate time limit, arguing that the Marketable Title Act allowed the claim to be presented up to 40 years after the deed was issued, recorded. And the court analyzed that issue and ultimately rejected it, finding that the suit was barred by the statute of limitations for fraud based on 6 years statute of limitations. So the court did not reach or make any findings on the actual merits of the case, i.e., whether appellant signed the deed that he denied signing, did not make any findings on the litany of other allegations or claims of bad acts that he was harassing the respondent in previous matters. The only issue that the court made a factual finding on was the applicability of the statute of 6-year statute of limitations and the legal contention that that statute of limitations was the one that applied to the case. So I think clearly the decision on which statute of limitations applies to a particular claim is a legal issue. If it's disputed what statute applies to a particular set of facts, that's a conclusion of law, that's a legal contention. And here, appellant's counsel argued unsuccessfully that the Marketable Title Act permitted this claim to go forward despite the appellant's admitted knowledge that he knew about this deed more than 6 years before the case was commenced. And I think that's significant. Counsel,
the district court, in ordering the sanctions, wrote, plaintiff has conducted himself in a fashion worthy of sanctions. What do you interpret that to mean?
Well, I interpret it as it's written as describing the conduct in the previous phrase, bringing this lawsuit.
Here's my confusion. I mean, your argument is the sanction order is impermissible because it's against a represented party, and the sanction order should be against the attorney because the attorney is ultimately responsible for signing the pleadings and knowing whether or not the claim is justified. And if that's the law, and the district court says plaintiff has conducted himself in a fashion worthy of sanctions, and there was other evidence in the record indicating that your client, as opposed to the attorney, did something improper, isn't it a little ambiguous as to what the district court's reasoning is?
Well, I don't think so, Judge, in light of Rule 11.03's requirement that the district court explain the basis for the sanctions.
Well, I don't know if that's much of an explanation. That's my point.
Well, the phrase that you're referring to, Judge, is preceded by a comma, not a period.
Okay.
So I think the only way to interpret that is that the conduct that the district court is referring to there is the bringing of the claim after the statute of limitations had expired. And again, I think that's supported by the fact that the judge didn't make findings or comments on all of the other issues that were raised at the summary judgment hearing and motion, as well as the motion for sanctions. The only findings that the court made were on this statute, the dispute over which statute of limitations applied. So, and I guess, you know, if you feel there is some ambiguity there, then, you know, it would, in my mind, it would be an abuse of discretion if the court intended to sanction the plaintiff for those sorts of acts that were alleged, because there were no findings made on those. And the rule requires the judge to make those sorts of findings and explain the basis.
Mr. Merritt, I have a question about your request for relief. In the conclusion of your brief at page 11, you asked that we reverse the district court's order in its entirety, alternatively, to reverse and remand to the district court for purposes of reconsideration with respect to the award of sanctions against appellant in light of 1103B1. Can you be more specific about the alternative request there, about exactly what, if we were to agree with you that there is error and that we should reverse and remand, what exactly do you want us to say in the remand order or in the opinion? I guess to be more specific, what remand instruction should we give the district court?
Yeah, I would rely on the Gibson case that cited in our brief, where the Supreme Court essentially sent the issue back to the lower court with the sole instruction to consider whether the sanctions should be awarded against the counsel in that case. I don't think a remand in this case should reopen all of the other asserted bases for sanctions that the court did not previously rule on. So in other words, stay with what the district court did find to be sanctionable conduct, the assertion of an unwarranted legal contention, and have the district court then consider whether that sanction should be imposed against appellant's counsel. I think appellant's counsel should be given the opportunity to respond to that, but he's not here. He's not part of the appeal, but on remand, I think he should be given the opportunity to address that issue. A couple of weeks ago, I woke up in the middle of the night and had a brilliant argument why the court should just flat out reverse and not remand. Clarence Darrow would have been proud of that argument. And I thought it was such a good argument that I didn't need to write it down. Well, of course, by morning, I had forgotten the argument. And frankly, I don't think the court can just reverse. I think if the court does agree with appellant here, a remand must be made in order to give the district court the opportunity and appellant's counsel the opportunity to address the issue of whether the sanction should be imposed against counsel in this case. And with the questions you've asked, I think I've covered everything I intended to cover. So I'll turn it over to respondent unless you have additional questions.
Just to be clear, Mr. Merritt, so I'm looking again at the conclusion of your brief on page 11. So you're essentially abandoning the first primary request for relief there, and you're relying solely on the alternative request stated there?
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you for your candor, Mr. Merritt. And if there are no other questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Olson. You ready to proceed, Mr. Olson?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ryan Olson, counsel for respondent Sherry Sweetnam. As stated in respondent's brief, respondent acknowledges that Rule 11 does not allow a district court to impose a monetary sanction against a represented party if the sanction is solely based on a finding that a claim was not warranted by existing law. In that specific circumstance, the monetary sanction should be imposed on the represented party's counsel. So as a result, Your Honor, I think, Your Honors, we have, as the way we see it, there are really three issues that the parties disagree on with respect to this appeal. One, it's the scope of the district court's February 15th, 2021 order. Two, it's whether there's an alternative basis upon which this court can affirm the district court's decision. And then three, if this court believes that the district court abused its discretion in awarding monetary sanctions against the appellant, then what is the result? And I think I'm going to address this third issue first, given the comments by Mr. Merritt here this morning. Your Honors, if the court finds that there is an abuse of discretion in this particular circumstance, I believe the proper result is that the case be reversed and remanded back to the district court for further consideration, but without limitation. I think the respondent in our brief, we cited the Stiff versus Associated Sewing Supply Company case, and that's at 436 Northwest 2nd, page 777. And in that case, the court held that when additional findings are necessary to support a trial court's conclusion on a disputed issue, an appellate court, of course, may remand for additional findings. And I think if the case, Your Honor.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a question when you're finished with your thought.
Oh, okay. So the point is that I think in this particular case, there would be no reason to remand the case and limit the court's reconsideration to just whether or not the monetary sanction should be imposed against appellant's attorney. The judge should be given the opportunity to also identify the additional bases, if any, with respect to the imposition of monetary sanctions against the appellant. And so where there's a disagreement between the respondent and the appellant at this point, as far as the relief that would be appropriate if appellant is correct, respondent just simply would suggest that the case would need to be reversed and remanded, giving the court the instruction of reconsidering the court's decision and then to make additional findings necessary to support the conclusion that the trial court wants to reach. And I think that if, and I'll get back to our other arguments in a second, I think that that opportunity for the district court certainly would address any concerns over clarity or any ambiguity. And I think, again, it's directly supported by the Stiff decision. Alternatively, and I think at the worst case scenario under the Gibson case that Mr. Merritt cites, the case would be remanded back to the district court for the court's ability to consider whether or not to impose the monetary sanctions against the appellant's attorney. But with that, Your Honor, I think that the appropriate action under Stiff in this particular circumstance would be to remand, allow the court, the district court, to reconsider without any limitations. And with that, Your Honor, I'd like to address your question.
Counsel, do you think the order is clear regarding the basis for sanctions, or is it ambiguous?
Given how many times I've read, Your Honor, I think it's probably, more ambiguous than I would care for. And maybe I'll take responsibility for that, before the district court. I do have a different reading of it and had a different reading of it. But when two people are standing before a court and arguing different sides, it generally leads to a conclusion that the language, if nothing else, could be more clear. And so I don't mean to size up the question, Your Honor, but I can certainly turn to why I think that the scope of the order can be read to be a bit different.
We shouldn't have to do that. I mean, we have a rule that says the district court has to explain the basis for its award of sanctions. And it seems like we've got two reasonable interpretations of this order. The district court says something that implies it's imposing sanctions under 1102B, which can only be imposed against the attorney. And yet here they're imposed against the client. So that creates a little bit of ambiguity. And then the district court mentioned some other conduct by the plaintiff, which perhaps could be a basis for an award of sanctions against the plaintiff, but doesn't specifically say that. So I guess I'm left wondering what the basis for the award is, and wondering if it's not clear, if that's the purpose of the remand. I mean, it just would go back with instructions to the court to comply with Rule 1103 and clearly explain the basis for the award, so everybody is on the same page there. And then if there's still a dispute about whether or not it's appropriate, it would come back to us.
I think that, Your Honor, if the court comes to that conclusion, I think that's exactly right.
I hear what you're saying about, well, there may be allegations in the record that could have provided a justification for the fee award, and the district court sort of vaguely references that. But we certainly don't have any findings on those allegations, and we can't make those findings and come up with an alternative basis.
I agree that those other findings are not present. I think on the alternative basis, I think the issue is that there are facts. The factual findings are that the appellant knew about the alleged fraud in early 2004. That after allegedly discovering it, they continued to jointly defend their undivided interest in the cabin in response to their father's cause of action, claiming a superior interest. The court found that the appellant did not raise any good faith argument to justify delay. And in this particular case, not in 2004, but in this case, in 2020, the appellant admitted in responding to response counterclaim that she had an undivided one-half interest in the family cabin when they jointly defended their interest against their father's cause of action. And I would suggest, as far as an alternative basis, that's an admission by the appellant. It doesn't require it to be additional finding. And I don't know how one could, with a straight face, make the argument that the document that gave Ms. Sweetnam that undivided interest in the cabin was fraudulent when he admits that 3 years after that document was signed by somebody, they had this undivided one-half interest. And so I think there's a lack of evidentiary support here. And I would just like to comment on how I think the order could be read to be unambiguous, but perhaps not as detailed as certainly this court would like. And that is this. I think there is importance associated with the finding that the cause of action was barred by the 6-year statute of limitations, or more specifically, barred by the statute of limitations. In our brief, we cited the Cole versus Star Tribune case, and I want to make it clear that case is not on point. And it's not on point because it deals with the older version of Rule 11, which was much like the older statute, which is 549.21. But the point that we're citing it for is simply its conclusion, as we understand it, that when that case, when the defamation action was commenced 2 days after the statute of limitations had passed, that there was no reasonable basis in law or fact to believe that that plaintiff could maintain that cause of action. And so when I am looking at paragraph 9, and the judge and the district court in this case made a point to say that, again, as you point out, the district court concluded that sanctions were justified against the plaintiff. And then she goes on in just paragraph 9 to indicate that, you know, pursuant to Rule 11.02 and 11.03, where this action was not warranted by existing law, comma, and in fact precluded by, and then it's the statute of limitations. To me, I think there's an issue of whether or not the finding that the cause of action was barred by the applicable statute of limitations has additional impact. In other words, it's not just that there's no reasonable basis in law for bringing the cause of action. There also can be no reasonable basis in fact. And does that then tie into Rule 11.02C as opposed to just 11.02B? And that was, I thought those were independent, not directly connected. I can also see a reading of it where they could be connected, or one could view it, but there's a comma before the and. And so that's where responding is coming from in the interpretation of that paragraph. Also, Your Honor, as the, Your Honors, we made an argument that hasn't been addressed, and it is an alternative basis argument. And it's an argument that the district court's decision could be affirmed based upon the court's inherent authority. And I think all the facts that would support that are frankly in the court's order or just flat out admitted by the appellant. And I think what's important here is that, and we cited the Murren versus Mosher case for this proposition, but the court has the inherent authority to issue sanctions when a party acts in bad faith, vexatiously, wantonly, over oppressive reasons. And in here, I think the facts support the proposition that the appellant's conduct goes, again, beyond just bringing a claim that was frivolous. The facts are a bit different. Again, the parties, the appellant and respondent, jointly defended their respective ownership interest in the family cabin in 2004. Right. And at that point, it is at that point, and when that cause of action was commenced, the appellant indicated that he first learned about the fraud, that is the forgery of that October 15th, 2001 quitclaim deed. Now, appellant indicates, as the court notes in her factual findings, that during his deposition in this case, he indicated that he had talked to his attorney about that at that point in time. But this taking that those facts, in addition to the fact of waiting over 15 years to commence the action, having no good faith basis for delay, and again, admitting in 2020 that they both had this undivided interest when they were both defending their interest and the action commenced by their father, the two are very much in conflict. And it's hard. In fact, that concession is in direct contrast to a claim that the October 15th, 2001 quitclaim deed was fraudulent.
Mr. Olson?
Yes.
These alternative arguments, did you present them to the district court?
We argued, actually, that's a great point, Your Honor. Before the district court, we actually argued that sanctions were appropriate against both appellant and appellant's attorney. And so we argued that sanctions were appropriate under 11.02 A, B, and C. So I hope I addressed your question, Your Honor, at that point.
And did you make an argument about inherent authority to the district court?
No, we did not, Your Honor.
One of my problems with your alternative arguments is that aren't these decisions that really ought to be made by the district court that presided over the case rather than three appellate judges who have much less familiarity with the case?
You know, the case law with the alternative bases talks about facts in the record. And I'll concede Mr. Merritt's point or appellate's point regarding, you know, the Court of Appeals not being in the business of fact finding. And so I agree with that, Your Honor, in the Rasmussen case, in the sense that we need to look to or it's at least unclear, and may need to look to facts that are found in the record itself. But I think the facts that I just noted with respect to the lack of evidentiary support and the facts that I think could warrant sanctions under the court's inherent authority are facts that are either included in the court's February 15th order or again amid by the appellant himself.
Counsel, just following up on Judge Johnson's question, it's my understanding that we are to review a district court's imposition of sanctions under Rule 11 for an abuse of discretion. Whenever I'm called on to review a decision for an abuse of discretion, the first thing I ask is, what did the district court judge decide and what were the reasons for that decision? And then I can look at the law and tell whether or not the district court applied the right law, applied it correctly, et cetera. So even beyond lack of factual finding, I question whether it's appropriate for this court to affirm an award of sanctions on an alternative basis when the standard review is abuse of discretion. I mean, this isn't like summary judgment where the standard review is de novo. We are to be reviewing a specific decision and not substituting our judgment for that of the district court. And I have a very difficult time doing that when I'm not sure what the basis for the district court's decision was. So I just want to be upfront with you that I think the alternative ground to affirm argument is a difficult one for me in this context because of the standard of review, especially where we have a rule that would seem to prevent this scenario by telling the district court, if you're going to impose sanctions, tell everyone what the reason is so it's clear. So just I think that's another concern on top of lack of factual findings that sort of piggybacks on the concern that Judge Johnson has raised. Understood. I think.
Judge Riley, can I ask just one more question, please?
Sure can.
So Mr. Olson, so well, I guess maybe two more questions. First, I mean, do you agree that for purposes of the sanctions, we're kind of confining ourselves to paragraph 9? Is that, you agree with that?
I do think paragraph 7 and 8 certainly provide color to paragraph 9. I also think that the court's conclusion in the June 1st, 2021 order.
Maybe I should say, for purposes of the explanation required by 11.03C, that the district court shall describe the conduct and explain the basis for the sanction imposed. And I think that means legal basis. I mean, for that purpose, are we looking only at paragraph 9?
Well, Your Honor, I guess from our perspective, I would look at, much like contract interpretation, I would look at the order as a whole. And I think the most germane paragraphs are paragraphs 7, 8, and 9. But I agree. 9 is where there's an articulation as to the conclusion. And then she references obviously the rules and identifies what I think are two bases. So I agree that 9 is the summary. I just, Your Honor, believe that her comments and the holdings in paragraph 7, 8 are also germane.
Okay. So my main question is, so obviously the language not warranted by existing law corresponds to paragraph B of 1102. You've identified, I guess, you're trying to make a connection between the citation to the limitations statute and paragraph C of 1102. Is there any other language in paragraph 9 that you think correlates to any of the other bases in 11.02?
Not in paragraph 9, Your Honor. In the June 1st, 2021 order, I think there is additional language the court included in her memorandum in support of that order, which is attached. That's the June 1st, 2021 order and is attached to the appellant's addendum. And the memo portion is on page 12 of that addendum. And the district court ultimately concludes, she says, ultimately, plaintiff had the ability, knowledge to stop and halt the action, but did not do so. That would could have supported the improper purpose, but I acknowledge that is not, that language is not in the February 15th, 2021 order.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Merritt, do you have any rebuttal?
Frankly, Your Honor, I think we've covered the issue. I don't have any further comments. I'd be happy to address any lingering questions you have.
Fellow judges, any lingering questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your helpful arguments and helpful briefs, and we will have our decision out within 90 days. And I think we'll stay.